You're listening to the Mens Rea podcast, and this is the story of Derek Benson. Just before 3 a.m. on Saturday, May 13th, in the year 2000, a call came in to Dublin Fire Brigade about a fire at a unit in the four-story Sandy Hill Avenue apartment complex in Ballymun on the north side of Dublin City. The alarm was raised after Claire Keeley, a resident of the building, heard screaming and noticed smoke billowing from one of the second-story flats. Three fire engines were dispatched to the scene along with two ambulances. Upon arrival, firefighters found the flat filled with thick smoke. In the main bedroom, they discovered the body of 33-year-old Derek Benson. First responders initially assumed that he had succumbed to injuries sustained in the inferno, but as the flames were subdued, it became clear that Benson's death had nothing to do with the fire. His body was covered in blood, and he had clear signs of significant trauma, prompting the firemen to summon Gardaí to the scene. Benson was taken by ambulance to the Mater Hospital, but due to the extent of his injuries, he was pronounced dead on arrival. Derek Benson was already known to Gardaí. The father of one was a small-time drug dealer with a reputation for having a volatile nature, and as the brutality of his injuries became clear, officers started to wonder if his death could be somehow related to his criminal activities. A full murder inquiry was launched, and within 24 hours, a team of 50 officers were on the hunt for Benson's killer. Officers wasted no time canvassing his neighbours for any information that could shed more light on the events surrounding his death. But as the details of this savage killing began to emerge, they found their investigation hampered by swirling rumours. A post-mortem was performed by state pathologist Dr. Mary Cassidy, who found that Derek's body was covered in knife wounds from head to toe. One incision to the neck was so deep that it cut through to the cervical spine, almost decapitating him. A number of wounds in his trunk had originated in the chest and gone the whole way through his body, exiting out the back. In total, Dr. Cassidy counted 85 cutting wounds, and she ultimately concluded that Derek Benson's cause of death was due to multiple wounds from a blade. The Irish media was already in a heightened state at the time, as three young Irishmen had been brutally killed in a similar fashion in the Netherlands 2 weeks before, and many people were now wondering if the attack on Derek Benson was some kind of copycat killing. To address these concerns, a press conference was called by Superintendent Albert Tracy, who was leading the investigation. He assured the gathered media that this was no copycat killing, and Benson's death bore no resemblance to the three that had occurred in The Hague. Superintendent Tracy went on to appeal to the public for help in solving the murder, asking that anyone who may have seen anything suspicious in the area around the time of the fire to come forward. He noted that they were still in the very early stages of the investigation and were not following a definite line of inquiry. Despite Gardaí stressing that they could find no connection between Benson's criminal activities and his death, Irish media outlets continued to run wild with rumour, comparing Benson's death to the killings in The Hague. Meanwhile, officers from the Garda Ballistics section commenced an examination of the apartment. Garda Tom Carey noted heavy smoke and scorch marks on the wall and ceiling over Derek Benson's bed. A wardrobe was toppled over on the bedroom floor, and upon closer inspection, Garda Carey saw that the top of it had suffered extensive fire damage, indicating that an attempt was made to set it alight. In the second bedroom of the flat, investigators found evidence to suggest that someone had attempted to light yet another fire. Gardaí were keeping an open mind as they continued their investigation on the ground. They spoke to Derek Benson's partner, Jackie Noble, who told them that she had left the flat at around 1:10 that morning to return to her deceased parents' house in Nowth Court, where she had been staying in recent times. This gave officers a timeline to work with, and they appealed for anyone who may have seen anything suspicious in the vicinity of Sandy Hill Avenue between 10 past 1 and 10 minutes to 4 in the early hours of May 13th to come forward. Given the bloody and brutal nature of Derek Benson's murder, officers knew that the killer's clothing would have been heavily blood-spattered, and they were sure that some residents of the apartment complex would have seen the attacker leaving the scene. On the Monday following Derek's death, an appeal was made on RTE's Crimeline television show, asking for anyone with information to come forward. Following the broadcast, an anonymous call was made to Gardaí about a pair of youths that were seen acting suspiciously in the area around the time of the killing, and officers set about investigating this lead. However, within the next 24 hours, the case would take an unexpected turn. On May 17th, 4 days after Derek Benson's killing, his partner Jackie Noble presented herself at Santry Garda Station, saying she wanted to make a statement. She was taken to an interview room by Detective Garda Andrew O'Keefe, where she revealed the details of her relationship with Derek Benson and gave a shocking account of the night of May 13th. Noble told Detective O'Keefe that she had met Derek Benson when she was just 16, but things had quickly turned sour between the couple. About 6 months into the relationship, on Halloween night, Benson became physically abusive when he kicked Jackie Noble so hard in the face that he gave her a black eye. What followed was almost 2 decades of horrific abuse. Noble gave the detective a detailed and harrowing account of her relationship with Derek Benson, alleging that he beat her frequently using his hands, feet, and whatever he had nearby that could be used as a weapon. Benson also subjected her to, quote, mental torture and sexual abuse. She asserted that Derek Benson was possessive and a control freak. Noble and Benson had a daughter who was 13 at the time of her father's death. She had also suffered at the hands of Derek Benson, who was known to physically assault his daughter from a young age. In addition to this abuse, Noble told detectives that in 1993, when the girl was just 5 or 6, her school principal had expressed some concerns over her behavior. This led to a suspicion that Benson may have been abusing their daughter sexually, and Noble took her to Temple Street Hospital for assessment. The young girl was examined and signs of abuse were found, so Gardaí were contacted. However, it was claimed that the child was then threatened by Benson and, as a result, her complaint was withdrawn and no charges were brought. Noble told Gardaí that in more recent times, Benson was using their teenage daughter to administer heroin to him, and he was allowing her to, quote, smoke joints and stuff. According to Jackie, Benson was also forcing their daughter to sell drugs on the street for him. She told Gardaí, quote, he was ruining her life, just like he ruined mine. Noble and Benson had lived together with their daughter in the flat in Sandy Hill Avenue for a number of years, but in the months leading up to the killing, Noble went to live at her parents' house in Nowth Court. Her mother had passed away some years before, while her father's death had been more recent, and she found comfort in the familiar surroundings of her childhood home. However, despite this brief respite, Benson still controlled many aspects of her life and the domestic abuse continued. When asked why she hadn't just left Derek Benson for good, Jackie Noble said that he had threatened that if she ever tried to leave him, he would cut their daughter up in front of her, and then stab her too. Given Benson's volatile temper and history of violence, Noble said she had no reason to doubt him. In her interview with Detective O'Keefe, Noble explained that her resentment had been seething for some time, but had come to a head in the weeks leading up to Benson's death. She had confided in an acquaintance named Paul Hopkins, telling him about the frequent beatings and abuse that she suffered from her partner. Hopkins was a 21-year-old bouncer who worked on the door of a pub in Drumcondra. Noble knew him because she had sold him a heroin substitute on a number of occasions, and he had also on occasion used her flat to smoke heroin. Noble admitted to detectives that she was also, quote, on gear. When Noble told Hopkins about the frequent vicious beatings that Benson put her through, she said that the young doorman had offered to do something about it for her. Hopkins had also had a number of run-ins with Benson in the past and was more than happy to help her exact some justice. Detective O'Keefe asked Noble how she responded to Hopkins' offer, and she claimed that she had told him that she wouldn't mind Benson getting a beating or ending up in a wheelchair, reasoning that this would help her to get away from him. She went on to tell Detective O'Keefe that she had hired someone to assault Benson 11 years earlier in the hope that it would be sufficient punishment to stop his abuse of her, but it hadn't worked and the beatings continued. After Hopkins had offered to, quote, do something about Derek, Noble said she agreed to pay him £3,000 for what she claimed was a planned assault, and she gave him an advance of £200. 2 days before the attack, Noble met with Hopkins, who gave her some sleeping tablets and a Nokia phone, and the pair hatched a plan. They agreed that Noble would go to the flat and drug Benson, and when the sleeping tablets started to take effect, she would contact Hopkins on the phone to let him know. Noble would then wait for Hopkins to arrive so she could let him in, and once he did, she would leave and go back to her parents' house on Nowth Court while Hopkins carried out the assault. On the evening of May 13th, Jackie told the detectives she went to Benson's flat at around 9 p.m. He was recovering from a dental procedure, so he was in bed, and the couple ate Mikado biscuits together while they watched the movie Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. Noble made coffee for Benson, lacing it with the sleeping tablets that Paul Hopkins had given her, and Dooley made contact with Hopkins on the phone. At around 10 past 1, Hopkins arrived. Noble said, quote, "He walked in and I walked out." A short time later, after she had arrived back at her parents' house in Nowth Court, Jackie Noble received a phone call from Benson's neighbour, Claire Keeley. Noble recounted that Claire told her that the flat was on fire and continued, quote, "I felt sick. Derek was never meant to be killed. Hurt, yes, but not killed." She was very insistent with Gardaí that she had no desire that Benson be killed. After giving her statement to Gardaí, Jackie Noble left the station without charge and signed herself into St. Vincent's psychiatric unit while officers went in search of Paul Hopkins. At 6:30 a.m. on May 18th, Gardaí raided Paul Hopkins' home in Saloak Road, Ballymun. They arrested Hopkins, taking him to Santry Garda Station for questioning. Hopkins soon realised that Gardaí knew everything and that lying would be futile. He told investigators that Derek Benson frequently demanded money from him and intimidated him. He claimed to be afraid of Benson, who he said regularly boasted about beating and cutting people up. Both Hopkins and Benson had been sent on a false course to the US together in the past, where the bullying continued. According to Hopkins, the situation culminated in Benson threatening to rape his girlfriend and baby girl before killing them. He told Gardaí he believed that Benson was a paedophile who had, quote, "interfered with children," so he thought the threat against his partner and child were credible. Hopkins said, quote, "When I heard this, I snapped. I despised him with a passion." Hopkins went on to say that a fortnight before the killing, he bumped into Noble. She was crying and told him that Benson had stolen a bracelet that had been given to her by her late father. She also confided in him about the beatings and other abuse that Derek Benson inflicted on her. After hearing this, Hopkins said that he offered to kill Benson for Jackie Noble. She said that she would pay him if he did, and made mention of £5,000. Following this conversation, the pair met again a number of weeks later and formulated a plan. Hopkins went to the apartment of his brother Michael, who collected swords. Paul told Michael that he knew a taxi driver who wanted to buy one of the swords and selected one from the collection. It was a black-handled Chinese model with a 12-inch curved blade. He gave his brother £80 for the weapon. He then bought a Nokia mobile phone and some sleeping tablets, and 2 days before Benson was murdered, Hopkins met Jackie to give her the phone and the medication. In the early hours of May 13th, Jackie Noble called Hopkins to say everything was going as planned. After hanging up, Hopkins armed himself with the sword and went to Benson's home at Sandy Hill Avenue. Jackie was just leaving the flat as he entered. In his statement, Hopkins said that he had asked Noble if she was sure she wanted to go ahead with the plan, and she replied that she was sure. He claimed to Gardaí that at the time he was trying to get out of the arrangement he had made, but nevertheless he had gone through with it. Hopkins then gave a gruesome and detailed account of the killing, saying that he took the sword from a bag and swung it at Derek Benson as he slept in bed. Benson woke up and started to wrestle with the sword. He was bleeding heavily and jumped from the bed in an attempt to escape, but Hopkins chased him. Hopkins admitted that he kept stabbing Benson until he died. He then described to the detectives how he set Benson's bedalight and threw lighting papers into the wardrobe to ignite it before leaving the flat with the sword. Hopkins later asked a friend named Lorna Langan to keep the sword at her flat in Sologue Road, but he didn't give her any information as to why he wanted her to hold it for him. Asked in the interview to describe his interactions with Jackie, Hopkins claimed that Noble had smiled as she asked him to kill Benson. He said that Jackie was calling the shots and asserted that the decision to kill Derek Benson was hers. He told Gardee that he had asked Noble if she really wanted it done, and she had replied, quote, "Yeah, I definitely want it done." Hopkins said that he was scared at the time, but that he had definitely made up his mind to stand up to Benson. Gardee charged Paul Hopkins with the murder of Derek Benson at 6:30 p.m. that evening. Officers also went to the home of Lorna Langan, where they recovered the sword in a wardrobe in one of her bedrooms. Meanwhile, they lay in wait for Jackie Noble, knowing that she was receiving inpatient care in St. Vincent's. 3 days after signing herself in, she was released and was leaving the unit when the car she was travelling in was stopped by Detective Sergeant Murphy. He told her that he was arresting her for the murder of Derek Benson, which caused her to collapse in the back seat of the car. Noble was taken to Santry Garda Station, where she was questioned further. She gave a similar account to her initial statement, but also added that she had tried repeatedly to have Benson harmed in recent years. She admitted that on one occasion she had paid £500 to a Northern Irishman to have Benson shot, but the man disappeared after being paid and nothing further came of the situation. She had also spoken to another individual who offered to give Derek Benson a, quote, dose of bad gear. Noble offered to pay the man to do this, but again, nothing came of it. Noble was then brought before Dublin District Court, where she was formally charged with the murder of Derek Benson. In response to the charge, she said, quote, "I am sorry. I am very sorry." The joint murder trial opened on January 12, 2004, before Mr. Justice Henry Abbott. Journalist Liz Walsh reported extensively on the proceedings for a number of national media outlets. In the time that had passed since the killing of Derek Benson, detectives had uncovered far more facts surrounding the case, and prosecuting counsel Tom O'Connell used these facts to illustrate the state's case for the jury. Prior to the contract killing agreement, Jackie Noble learned that she was due to inherit an amount of money and a portion of property from her late father's estate. Derek Benson had already laid claim to some of the money, intending to use it to buy an apartment and a motorbike. Mr. O'Connell contended that it was this demand for money that precipitated the agreement between Jackie Noble and Paul Hopkins. The prosecuting counsel detailed the extent of Derek Benson's injuries, describing in particular the 7 wounds where the sword went through his body completely from front to back. He outlined the violent nature of Benson and Noble's relationship, the imminent inheritance, and Derek Benson's plan to spend the money once Noble received it. The state maintained that this is what put the murder plan into motion, though acknowledging that Jackie Noble had contemplated killing Benson for some time. Senior Counsel O'Connell stated, quote, "The plan was that Mr. Hopkins would actually kill Mr. Benson, and he would do this at the request of Ms. Noble, who paid him a certain amount of money up front and agreed to pay him more after Benson was killed." Mr. O'Connell described for the jury the meeting between Noble and Hopkins that took place 2 days before the murder, telling the jury that a mobile phone and sleeping tablets exchanged hands. Senior Counsel for the prosecution argued, quote, "It was agreed that she would go to the flat and drug Mr. Benson, and she would then contact Mr. Hopkins when the coast was clear. She would then leave, and he would kill him." The jury was told that they would hear evidence from neighbours of Derek Benson, who heard screaming at around 3 a.m. before seeing smoke coming from his flat. Counsel explained that Hopkins had set fire to the flat after killing Mr. Benson, though they admitted that this was not part of the original plan. Counsel asserted that because Noble had, quote, "engaged Hopkins to kill her partner," she was equally responsible for Derek Benson's death. because the pair had acted in joint enterprise. First to the stand was Claire Keeley, who lived in the unit adjoining Derek Benson. She told the court that around 3 a.m. on the 13th of May, she had heard screaming coming from Benson's flat. She said that her attention was drawn when she heard someone who she believed was Benson shouting, "For God's sake." Claire looked out her window to see what was going on, and it was then that she noticed smoke and fire billowing from Benson's home. She placed a call to the emergency services before also ringing Jackie Noble to tell her that the flat was on fire. Under cross from Paul Hopkins' defense counsel, Isabel Kennedy, the witness agreed that she was aware of a barring order in place between Benson and Noble. Speaking of the abuse perpetrated on Noble by Benson, Claire Keeley said, quote, "She wanted to get out because of the violence and the way he treated her." Ms. Keeley went on to recall an occasion when Jackie Noble ran into her flat to escape Benson. She told the court, quote, "He ran after her into my bedroom. He was killing her." According to Claire Keeley, Benson then started beating and kicking Noble when she was on the ground. Asked to describe her relationship with Jackie Noble, Ms. Keeley said that they were neighbours when Noble lived at the Sandy Hill Avenue complex. She recalled the first time they had met, saying that Noble's hand was very swollen. Keeley asked her what had happened, and Noble had responded that she had not made Benson's breakfast that morning, so he hit her with a plank of wood on the hand. The witness went on to tell Isabel Kennedy that she was afraid of Derek Benson. She'd argued with him about something in the past, after which Miss Keeley alleged he, quote, "threatened to burn me out of it." She reported the threat to Gardaí at the time, but no charges were ever brought in relation to the matter. Mary Ellen Ring, defending Noble, asked Ms. Keeley if she knew what would happen in the aftermath of the assaults by Derek Benson. Ms. Keeley said that it was always Jackie Noble who would say sorry after the rows, and never Benson. The defense barrister asked the witness if she was aware that Benson had assaulted Noble's father, and Claire responded that she hadn't seen it, but that she had been told about the incident. Ms. Keeley was also asked about whether she knew if Benson was thought to be dealing drugs in addition to his personal use, which she confirmed she did. And when asked by defense counsel if she thought that Derek Benson was liked in the area, Ms. Keeley responded that she didn't think so, and that people were mostly afraid of him. Ms. Keeley then told the court that Benson had a violent temper and that Jackie Noble could never leave him because he would not allow her to. She testified, quote, "He'd said he'd kill her first." State pathologist Dr. Mary Cassidy took to the stand and gave evidence of the 85 wounds that Derek Benson had suffered as he was attacked. The pathologist said that Benson had suffered 25 stab injuries, with a number of the wounds going through the body front to back. In addition to this, Dr. Cassidy found that Benson had sustained an additional 60 cutting or incised wounds, which extended from head to toe. She said this had been a, quote, "sustained and vicious assault." The pathologist described a total of 17 wounds to Benson's head and neck, including a gaping wound, which cut through his throat to the cervical spine. The jury heard that this was a, quote, "slicing or hacking injury," which Dr. Cassidy believed was as a result of an attempt to decapitate the victim. She also noted a number of wounds to the scalp and face, some of which extended from mouth to ear. Derek Benson's right kidney, lung, liver, spleen, and aorta were all punctured during the attack, and Dr. Cassidy told the court that she had determined the cause of death to be, quote, "multiple stab, incise, and cutting injuries to the head, trunk, and limbs." She added that toxicology reports carried out on Benson showed levels of methadone, sleeping tablets, and Valium. The drugs, said the pathologist, would have had a cumulative sedative effect. Following Dr. Cassidy's evidence, an officer began to read Jackie Noble's statements to Gardaí for the court, detailing the horrific violence she had suffered at the hands of Benson and her subsequent attempts to have him assaulted and injured. However, halfway through, the trial was adjourned so that legal argument could take place in the absence of the jury. This had already happened a number of times in the first few days of the proceedings, and on this occasion, the adjournment was expected to last no longer than a day or two. However, the legal arguments ended up dragging on for almost 3 weeks in the end, before the trial finally resumed on February 3rd to hear the remainder of Jackie Noble's statements to Gardaí. The jury heard Noble's account of eating biscuits and watching movies with Benson on the night he died before she let Paul Hopkins into the flat and headed back to Nowth Court. The next witness was Detective Sergeant Matt Murphy, who gave evidence to the court about a barring order that was in place between Benson and Noble at the time of the killing. The order had arisen after an assault by Benson, which resulted in Noble being hospitalized for broken ribs. Next, Paul Hopkins' initial statement to Gardaí was read aloud. The jury heard the defendant's account of his complicated and tense history with Derek Benson. Hopkins' version of the lead-up to the killing was then recited, as well as the killing itself, and how he had given the sword to a friend to hold in the aftermath of the crime. This was followed up with evidence from Detective Garda Andrew O'Keefe, who recounted travelling to the home of Lorna Langan to retrieve the weapon. The detective recalled that when he arrived at the flat with a number of other officers, they were invited in by Miss Langan's partner. Miss Langan herself arrived a short time later, and she gave permission to Gardaí to search the home. He described the discovery of the sword in the wardrobe of a bedroom in the flat. In other evidence, Detective Garda Tom Carey of the Garda Ballistics Section detailed the attempt made to set Derek Benson's apartment on fire. The jury were shown photographs from the scene which depicted scorch marks over Benson's bed, as well as the fire-damaged wardrobe. Detective Garda Carey also recounted the heavy blood-staining that he encountered in the bedroom where Derek Benson had been sleeping when he was attacked. Paul Hopkins' brother Michael was the next witness to give evidence. He told the Central Criminal Court that he had been on drugs since 1997 and was addicted to heroin. Tom O'Connell, senior counsel, asked Michael if he knew Jackie Noble and Derek Benson, and he said that he did. Counsel then asked him if he knew that his brother Paul had been getting the heroin substitute, Phycetone, from Noble, and again Michael answered that he did. Questioning then turned to Michael's weapon collection, which he said he had been building for a while. At the time of the killing, he said he owned a number of different swords. Michael recalled giving one of his swords to his brother Paul in the days leading up to the death of Derek Benson, telling the court that he believed that the blade was being sold to a taxi driver, with Paul being the middleman. He said he was paid £80 for the weapon. When asked by Tom O'Connell who had given him the money, Michael replied, "Paul." The final witness called by the prosecution was Paul Hopkins' former girlfriend, Lisa Morehouse. Lisa wept as she told the court that Derek Benson had threatened her and her baby on four separate occasions, and that he once chased her with a butcher's knife. She told senior counsel Tom O'Connell that Hopkins initially denied any involvement in the killing. However, she said he later broke down and said he didn't mean to do it and that he wanted to go to the Gardaí. Isabel Kennedy, defending Hopkins, asked the witness how she felt about Derek Benson. Lisa said that she was afraid of him and continued, quote, "He was just a horrible person." She recounted one instance when Benson had accosted her while she was holding her baby. She claimed he had pointed at her and her daughter, saying, quote, "See you, you stupid bastard. I'm going to petrol bomb you and the little bastard out of it." Ms. Kennedy asked the witness if she had taken this threat seriously, and Lisa responded that she had, adding, quote, "Everyone knows he was a blade merchant and carried blades. He'd already chased me with a knife." Lisa told the court that she was a recovering drug addict. She said she was no longer in a relationship with Paul Hopkins, but described their past relationship as good, apart from their mutual drug use, and said he had treated her like a queen. However, after the killing, she noticed a change in Hopkins, saying that he became, quote, "very messed up." She told Ms. Kennedy that her daughter was now in the custody of Paul Hopkins because, she said, he was a brilliant father. On February 9th, Paul Hopkins entered the witness box to give evidence in his own defense. By this stage, the trial was in its fourth week, having been beset by prolonged legal argument. Hopkins told the court that Derek Benson was a, quote, "psychopath." He detailed how he had been bullied and assaulted on five occasions over a four-year period by Benson, but said that it was not until Benson threatened to harm his girlfriend and baby daughter that he decided to stand up to him. His defense counsel, Isabel Kennedy, put it to Hopkins that he went to Derek Benson's flat with a sword, and the defendant agreed that this was the case. She asked him what he intended to do once inside, and the defendant said that he'd wanted to scare Derek Benson. He went on to detail the events that transpired in Benson's flat to the jury, saying that he had poked the other man with a sword as he lay in bed. Benson woke, jumped up, and a struggle ensued, during which the sword fell to the floor. Hopkins claimed that when this happened, Benson had picked it up and swung it at him. The defendant added that his fingers were cut as he tried to take the weapon back, and at that point, he lost control. Hopkins testified, quote, "I think I went into a frenzied attack. I just started swinging." Ms. Kennedy asked her client how he felt after the killing, and Hopkins said that he was, quote, "sick and scared about a lot of things." He alleged that Derek Benson was a violent man and claimed that he, quote, "interfered with children." Hopkins recalled being in Boston on a FOSS course when Benson threatened to petrol bomb his girlfriend Lisa and his daughter, quote, "after he was finished with them." Hopkins told the jury that he took this to mean that he would rape Lisa and the baby. Ms. Kennedy asked Hopkins if he had meant to kill or cause serious harm when he went to Benson's flat that night. He responded that he had only wanted to stand up to a man he thought was a bully, and added that it had taken him 4 years and a threat to his child to actually attempt to stand up to him. He was insistent that he had never meant to kill Derek Benson. On his second day in the witness box, Hopkins was cross-examined by Dominic McGinn for the prosecution. He denied ever telling Gardee that Jackie Noble had offered to pay him to kill Derek Benson, and insisted that money had never been mentioned in his conversations with his co-defendant. Mr. McGinn put it to him that, according to his Garda statement, Jackie was calling the shots. Hopkins disagreed, reiterating that he had made his mind up to stand up to him, and that he had been scared when it came time to actually act upon this. The next day, Jackie Noble gave some of the most harrowing and emotional evidence of the trial. She recalled the beginning of her relationship with Benson and how things had turned violent after 6 months. Noble had been just 16 at the time. She told the jury, quote, "He gave me a kick into the face at Halloween. He busted my eye." Noble said that she subsequently became pregnant with Benson's child, but on her mother's advice, she had a termination. Her parents were very concerned for her, and they wanted her to keep away from him, but she was already growing increasingly fearful of Benson's volatile nature. She told the court that she became pregnant again, and this time she had the baby, a little girl. Noble recalled that at the child's christening, Benson became very drunk. He ended up smashing the windows in her parents' house and assaulted her father, biting him on the back. She said that these bite marks were visible on her father's back up until the day he died. Noble said that she had 3 more abortions after her daughter was born because she refused to have another baby with Benson due to the beatings. Noble detailed the litany of physical abuse that she had experienced at the hands of Benson. She alleged that he would use his fists, feet, and objects to beat her on a regular basis. She recounted one incident where he split her eye open because his stew was not on the right side of the plate. Noble said Benson often aimed his blows at her back so that no one else would see the marks. Noble then turned her face away from the court as she gave details of the horrific sexual abuse that she had suffered from Benson. The defendant said that her sisters were unaware of the extent of the abuse, and it distressed her greatly to recount it. Benson, she said, would often tie her to a bed or a chair before raping her orally or anally. Her defense counsel, Mary Ellen Ring, asked if Benson had ever been violent towards their daughter, and Noble recalled one occasion where she caught him kicking and punching her in the bedroom. The little girl was just 7 or 8 at the time. Noble called Gardee and they took Benson away, but he was released and back at the flat the very next morning. In her second day of evidence, Noble described how Benson taught their daughter to inject him with heroin when she was just 13. He also claimed that he allowed the teen to smoke hash and forced her to sell what Noble called rips on the street for him. She went on to tell her defense barrister that her daughter had often slept in the same bed as her father, and she suspected that Benson had had sex with another 13-year-old girl who had spent the night at his flat. Noble broke down frequently on the stand as she gave her evidence. She explained her ultimate goal to the jury, telling them, quote, "I just wanted to get away from him, to let me and my daughter live in peace." She said she had regularly sought refuge with friends after the beatings from Benson and described herself as a bag lady, always going off to stay somewhere else, away from him. The defendant went on to testify that it got to the point that she could no longer live with the ongoing physical, sexual, and mental torture. She said she would often wake up in the morning to find Benson leering over her, wearing a balaclava and holding a knife to her throat. She wept and stated, quote, "I just had enough. My brain was exploding with everything." After Jackie Noble's evidence concluded, Garda Sinead McGee told the court that she was on duty in Ballymun in 1997 when she heard Derek Benson shouting up at Jackie Noble's flat. Noble told the officer that she had a barring order against Benson, and Garda McGee told him to leave the area. However, as she spoke to Jackie Noble, Benson managed to sneak into the flat. Garda McGee arrested him and brought him before the district court. He was granted bail, and as he was being brought to sign the bond, he told Garda McGee, quote, "I guarantee you that I'll be back in Jackie's flat tonight, and she won't be making a complaint." Garda McGee returned him to court immediately, and his bail was revoked. Later, as she was bringing Benson through the tunnel to the cells, she described how Benson had swung around and struck her in an apparent attempt to knock the guard down the stairs. As a result of this incident, Benson was further charged and jailed for 6 months. Jackie Noble's GP, Dr. Maurice Houston, gave evidence that supported all of the defendant's claims of injury caused by Derek Benson. Dr. Houston had treated Noble repeatedly between 1994 and 1999, and he detailed a litany of injuries that she had attended the surgery with, including fractured ribs, bruises to the chest and back, kicks to the back and shoulder, and extensive bruising to the body and thighs. On at least two occasions, the GP said he had referred her to A&E to have x-rays performed. According to Dr. Houston, Jackie Noble's main concern was for the welfare of her daughter. He recalled Noble as an excellent mother and said she cared for her daughter extremely well. The doctor concluded his evidence saying that he always advised Noble to contact Gardaí, but the cycle of abuse had continued. Next, the jury heard evidence from Ms. Anne O'Connor, who was a clinical psychologist attached to St. Clair's unit of Temple Street Children's Hospital. Ms. O'Connor said that in 1993, Jackie Noble brought her daughter to the unit to be seen. She told the court that St. Clair's unit was a particular department of the hospital that assessed suspected cases of child sexual abuse. The final witness called by Jackie Noble's defense team was her sister Wendy Dalton. Wendy broke down as she told the court how she had witnessed Derek Benson assaulting her sister on a number of occasions. Through tears, Wendy recalled, quote, "You could be with him in the same room and he'd just turn around and give her a clatter in the face, or maybe a box." She recalled one incident in particular that occurred in her parents' house, as she and Jackie stood in the kitchen chatting. Benson had walked in and started arguing and threatening Jackie. He pulled up his fists and told Wendy, quote, "Don't think I won't hit you either." Wendy's boyfriend tried to stop him, and Derek Benson pulled a knife out of his back pocket. On another occasion, the witness said that Jackie had been staying at her parents' house as their father was dying. Wendy walked in to find her sister in a state. Her hair was in disarray, and there was a mark on her cheek. Wendy went on to describe Benson's volatility and the fear that he induced in everyone around him. What stuck out in Wendy's mind was how Benson's whole face would contort and he would be almost, quote, foaming at the mouth. Wendy recalled, quote, "It was frightening to look at. Once you'd see Derek, you'd always be shaking. My legs would turn to jelly." In his closing speech, Tom O'Connell, prosecuting, told the jury that there was no defense in this case. Counsel said that the evidence that Jackie Noble had had a, quote, "dog's life" at the hands of Derek Benson was no justification for having him killed. He argued, quote, "On this night, there was no attack on Ms. Noble. Prosecution asks you to bring in a verdict of guilty in relation to Mr. Hopkins and Ms. Noble." Counsel for Hopkins and Noble didn't agree. Isabel Kennedy, defending Hopkins, said that the assertion that there was no defense in the case was absolutely absurd. The barrister argued that the defense of self-defense was open to her client, as he had not gone to the flat with the intention of killing Derek Benson. He had gone to frighten Benson, she said. Ms. Kennedy reminded the jury that Hopkins was clearly in fear of Benson, having been threatened by him on a number of occasions. She said that Benson should not have been killed but she asked the court to look at the characters of both Noble and Hopkins, who up till this point had never been in trouble with Gardee. Ms. Kennedy said that this was in stark contrast to Derek Benson, who had been described by his very own mother as, quote, violent and evil. Counsel concluded her speech by suggesting that Derek Benson was not only a violent man with a nasty temper, but that he was also suspected of child sexual abuse. She asked the jury to consider how that may have impacted on Paul Hopkins' mind, given that the focus of his life was his 18-month-old daughter. Jackie Noble's defense counsel, Mary Ellen Ring, made a similar plea in her closing speech. Ms. Ring asserted that the killing of Derek Benson was one carried out in self-defense. Noble, she said, was beaten again and again and again for years. She had secured barring orders, but these were always breached by Benson. Counsel asked the jury to consider the occasion when Benson fractured Noble's ribs in 1997. If Noble had struck him and pierced him in the heart during this incident, it would have been seen as a classic case of self-defense. Ms. Ring also asked the jury to take Benson's treatment of his 13-year-old daughter into consideration when he showed her how to shoot up heroin. She reminded them of the other incidents of abuse against the young girl and told them to ask themselves how this might have affected Jackie Noble. She closed her speech by asking the jury to acquit her client of murder. After hearing Justice Henry Abbott's charge, the jury retired to consider their verdict. After 7 hours of deliberation, the 7 men and 5 women returned with a unanimous verdict, finding both Paul Hopkins and Jackie Noble guilty of murder. 2 of the female jurors and 2 of the male jurors were visibly upset as the verdict was read out. Jackie Noble cried with her sisters while supporters of Paul Hopkins sobbed at the back of the court. Mandatory life sentences were handed down to both defendants. After the trial, it emerged that much of the lengthy legal argument that took place during the proceedings was centered around counsel for Hopkins and Noble attempting to have the defense of provocation considered by the jury. However, Mr. Justice Henry Abbott ultimately refused to allow the jury to consider this avenue. Psychiatric and psychological evidence to support Jackie Noble's state of mind was also ruled inadmissible by the judge. Following the sentencing, Mr. Justice Abbott refused both Hopkins and Noble leave to appeal their sentences. According to Ken Fox's book Revenge, Jackie Noble's daughter Kelly was not present in court to hear the verdict in her mother's case, as she had already been taken into care and was living with a foster family. However, she maintained a close bond with Jackie and visited her regularly in the Doca Center, where she was imprisoned. A number of months after the sentencing, Kelly gave an interview to Joe Duffy on his Liveline radio show, which was broadcast on RT Radio 1. Throughout the interview, the girl referred to Jackie repeatedly as "me poor ma." The then 18-year-old Kelly detailed the horrific legacy of trauma that her father's abuse had had on her life. She said that as a child, she frequently witnessed Benson's explosive violence on her mother, and that she herself was also beaten regularly by her father. The young woman went on to tell the radio presenter that her life had been destroyed by what she called her father's evil and violent spirit. She said, quote, "I'd hear him killing me, ma, all the time in the next bedroom. I'd lie there with my hands over my ears just praying to God he'd stop. He bashed me loads of times as well. When I was 8, he broke a tennis racket on my chin and I had to get 8 stitches. Kelly's voice trembled as she recalled the horrific violence rained down on her and her mother at the hands of her father. She insisted, quote, "My father that she killed was an animal. My poor mother is in jail now because she tried to protect me from that." Unfortunately for Kelly Noble, her troubled background would have a far-reaching effect on her future. 2 years after her mother was convicted for murder, Kelly found herself in court, charged with stabbing another young woman to death. Kelly was 20 years old at the time and was a mother to 2 young children. In the months following her mother's incarceration, Kelly had moved to the Seaview Estate in Laytown, County Meath, in the hope of making a fresh start. She enrolled in school locally and made friends with a number of teenage girls, including one named Emma McLaughlin. Unfortunately, things soured between the girls, culminating in a row at Laytown Railway Station, during which a pregnant Emma claimed that Kelly Noble kicked her in the stomach. The pair had fallen out after this, and an incident was subsequently reported to Gardee when McLaughlin tried to attack Noble with a hammer. However, their paths hadn't crossed much in the years since. According to an article written by Sorka Griffith for the Irish Independent, on June 2nd, 2006, Kelly Noble was at her home with her two children and her friend and occasional babysitter, Niamh Cullen. The women had spent the day together and Noble was braiding Cullen's hair as a birthday gift when she realised that she needed cigarettes along with some other groceries. She asked Cullen to watch her daughter and headed to the local supermarket, pushing her young son in a buggy. While inside the supermarket, Noble was approached by Emma McLaughlin, who started to row with her. McLaughlin allegedly punched Noble in the nose before being asked to leave the shop. It was at this point Kelly Noble rang Niamh Cullen, asking her to bring a knife down to the shop. Cullen grabbed a knife from the kitchen block and put it into a child's school bag. By the time she arrived at Pat's supermarket, Cullen said Emma McLaughlin had the exit of the shop blocked so that Noble couldn't leave the building without passing by her. Cullen entered the shop, handing the school bag to Noble, who hung it on the back of her son's buggy. Noble then took the knife from the bag and slipped it up her sleeve. As the two women left the shop, McLaughlin lunged at Noble, who slid the knife out and plunged it into McLaughlin's chest as Noble's two children looked on, crying. Following her arrest, Kelly Noble told Gardaí that she had no intention of killing anyone and that she was afraid of getting her head kicked in by McLaughlin. She claimed, quote, "It was self-defense, big time." Following her trial, Kelly Noble was found guilty of manslaughter. She was sentenced to 10 years in prison, which was to be served alongside her mother in Mountjoy Women's Prison. However, just weeks after her sentencing, she was transferred to Limerick Prison following a row with her mother, Jackie. She was eventually returned to Mountjoy a number of months later, but continued to get into trouble over the course of her sentence, attacking a prison officer on one occasion and preventing officers from seizing a drug-laden orange on another. In 2008, Kelly had her sentence reduced to 8 years, with the final two suspended. She was released just before Christmas in 2010. In 2016, she was jailed again, this time for 6 months, after she was found to be carrying a carving knife and three Stanley blades in her handbag as she went to a christening. Jackie Noble, on the other hand, kept her head down in prison, earning her temporary release on a number of occasions. She was formally released at the end of 2017, having served a total of 14 years for the murder of Derek Benson. Paul Hopkins was freed on license before Christmas in 2022. Jackie Noble has been frank and open about her actions, and following her release, she gave an interview to journalist Alison O'Reilly, saying she hoped she could now get on with the rest of her life and focus on her family. She told the journalist, quote, "What happened happened. I went in for it, and that's the way it is. I can't change it." She went on to say, quote, "I'm glad I'm out. To be honest, I'd just like to write a book and get on with it. I want to take care of my daughter and grandkids and get on with it." Thank you for listening to Mens Rea, a true crime podcast. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Mens Rea Pod, or you can send an email to mensreapod@gmail.com. Our theme music is Quinn's song The Dance Begins by Kevin MacLeod. Additional music is by Juanita Meisel and Kevin MacLeod. Thanks, as always, to our patrons for supporting the show. This week's episode was researched and written by the amazing Aileen Spirin. Additional writing and production was by me, your host, Sinead. All sources for today's episode can be found in the show notes or on our website, www.mensreapod.com. And so, till next time, don't do anything I wouldn't do.